Formula One's paddock is just full of velociraptors in dinner suits. It's all about the way you look, it's about total ruthlessness. Can that make for great drama? You bet.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast. Now this month, the Formula One world is celebrating the great Brazilian Formula One champion, Ayrton Senna, who died 30 years ago. For many lovers of the sport, myself included, he remains the greatest driver of all time. His story and his passionate, intense character are captured in the 2010 documentary movie Senna, a film that really crossed Formula One over into mainstream entertainment audiences. This wasn't a film about racing cars and race results. This was a film about a human being. So without the Senna movie, would Drive to Survive have been the crossover hit it's been? And would Formula One have the fan base it has today? We're going to talk a little bit later on to the writer and producer of Senna, Manish Pandey. With me in the studio, we have Rebecca Clancy, editor-in-chief of Autosport. Hi, Rebecca, how are you doing?
Hi, James. Thanks very much for having me. I'm very hot currently as we're recording this in Miami.
Indeed. We're not used to this kind of temperature,
No, we are not. We've had a terrible spring so far in the UK.
From a British winter. But Julianne Serrasoli will be more used to it because she is a freelance journalist from Brazil with over 13 years' experience at the front line of Formula One journalism. Bom dia, Julianne.
Bom dia, James. Thanks for having me here. I would if I wasn't living in the UK for 8 years now, so I'm suffering. We're all on the same boat here.
So tell me, what does Ayrton Senna mean to you?
Ayrton Senna, for me now, he's an example of self-improvement, of always pushing really hard, pushing the boundaries. He wasn't a perfect man. He was a very human man. I think that's part of the reason why we're still talking about him until today, because he had his flaws, but he was just trying to do the best he could and bringing the sport to a more of a human side. I think he was the ultimate storyteller of F1, because you can do a very good pole lap, but you can do a very good pole lap and then say you're speaking to God. So I think that's part of the reason why we're still talking about him and why he's so loved in Brazil and he means so much for all of us and me personally.
Yeah, I think you can't understate just how important Senna was to Formula One. In life, he changed the way drivers approached the sport in nutrition and exercise, on the mental side as well. In death, the amount of work that went into the safety side of Formula One, that still continues now, and a lot of that came about because of that accident that Senna had, and obviously the day before, Roland Ratzenberger as well. He is so important. He's almost one of those first drivers that really transcended the sport. Everyone loved him. As Julianne said, he wasn't perfect, but he was a perfectionist. The detail that he went into and how he managed to get his personality across from even inside the cockpit, you know, the helmet's almost very constrictive, but he managed to get across who he was, the love of the sport, and he died doing what he loved. And I think a lot of people are just so fascinated by him for all those reasons.
So Senna very much front of mind in this podcast. But before we delve into his story, there has been a seismic news event in Formula One in the last week involving someone who also, ironically, features prominently in Senna's story at the very end. Adrian Newey, the greatest racing car designer of all time, has quit Red Bull Racing, Formula One's dominant team, and is available on the market from as early as spring 2025. Rebecca, give us your explainer of why this has happened and what you think it's going to mean for the competitive balance of Formula One.
Well, why is certainly the question. As you say, Adrian Newey, widely regarded as the best car designer in Formula One, has been with Red Bull since almost the very start. Absolutely key personnel in terms of designing these cars, which have won all the championships, the dominance that we are seeing from Red Bull and Max Verstappen now. He announced, well, actually, it started to leak, shall I say, as it always does in Formula One with the rumours and the gossip. Started to leak last week, just before the Miami Grand Prix, that he was looking to leave. He was having conversations. And then Red Bull confirmed it just earlier this week, ahead of the Grand Prix, that he was departing. As you say, James, he is due to leave at the start of 2025. And his departure comes in the wake of the Christian Horner controversy. And I don't think we can talk about Newey's departure without addressing what's happening with Horner at the moment. If you're not up to date with this, Horner has been accused by a female colleague of coercive behaviour, inappropriate behaviour, and Horner was cleared by a Red Bull independent, they say, investigation. He has denied all wrongdoing, but there are undoubtedly huge power plays going on in Red Bull at the moment. We're seeing it between Helmut Marko, who is the I don't even know how you describe him anymore, the driver,
director,
driver development advisor, senior everything. So Helmut Marko on one side with Jos Verstappen, the father of Max Verstappen, and then on the other side we have Horner. And these allegations, which are incredibly serious and are still actually rumbling on in the background, and there are plenty of legal reasons why we can't discuss that more, that is still happening. This power play is still happening, and Adrian Newey, from what I understand, he just wants to design cars. And so he has taken the decision now to, at 65 years old, I think he is now, to step away. And he will still stay with Red Bull for the rest of the season. He will be attending a few races, the team have confirmed. More importantly, on the commercial side, he will still be involved in the development of the RB17, the road car, which will obviously have all of the Formula One technology. That's been a huge project for Red Bull. I think they're only making 50 of those cars. And having Adrian Newey attached to that is obviously a key selling point for Red Bull. But he is on the market, and I don't think it would be an understatement to say the teams are probably clamoring over him, for him, more than any other driver. You talk about seismic events. We had one obviously earlier in the year with Lewis Hamilton announcing that he was leaving Mercedes to go to Ferrari. The big punt at the moment is that Adrian Newey will be following Lewis Hamilton to Ferrari. We know there have been conversations going on between Fred Vasseur, the Ferrari team principal, and Adrian Newey. We know also that Aston Martin, who are owned by Canadian billionaire Lawrence Stroll, are throwing money at Adrian Newey to come and get him to move, well, just up the road actually, Aston Martin based in Silverstone, not far from Red Bull and Milton Keynes. So there is a lot of interest in Adrian Newey, very understandably. It will be fascinating to see what he does. Will he actually decide to retire? I somehow doubt it. The man is a workaholic. I suspect we will see him pop up somewhere else. And the really interesting thing in terms of what that means for Formula One is that he will be joining a team in 2025. And any team in that position at the start of that year will be looking ahead to 2026. The new regulations are coming in. And yes, they will be quite far down the line with the development of that 2026 car. But someone like Adrian Newey, I'm not overstretching to call the man a genius. He will be able to walk in and say, that's wrong, do this, do that. And that team, whoever hires him, will immediately have the advantage.
And of course, he'll also have a pretty decent idea of what Red Bull's 2026 car is going to look like as well. It's very unusual someone as senior as this, with so much knowledge in his head, has such a short gardening leave. But there's obviously in the background legal reasons why he's been able to sort of to shortcut that. Julian, I mean, the guy's unbelievable. He's won 25 world championships, drivers and constructors. I mean, head and shoulders ahead of anybody else. I mean, what do you make of this story? You know, his motives for leaving and what happens next?
I think Rebecca's touched on a very important thing, which is all the power struggle that's going on at Red Bull, the stuff that we can all talk about. And I think Adrian is talking about it in the best possible way by leaving. There's nothing else he can do about it. But also there was other stuff that we know from the background, Christian Horner coming in the last few months talking about Pierre Vacher, talking about the other people in the technical department and saying, oh, Adrian, you all talk about Adrian, but Adrian is not actually hands-on on the car anymore, which is true. But what Adrian has been doing at Red Bull for a few years now is just getting there, going with the silver bullet and saying, okay, this is a waste of time, you have to go here. So for these regulations, for example, he said, okay, I'm going to focus on the suspension. And then everybody tried to copy the Red Bull suspension because that was the key to make the car as low as they could run in every single circuit that made them big. So although he's not actually designing the car anymore, he makes them save time. And when you have budget cap, when you have the aero restrictions, the percentage of error development that every team can have, that makes a huge difference. So it is a huge asset for whoever hires him. And I can resonate what was going on between Lewis and Mercedes. Lewis getting just a 2-year deal and feeling, okay, I'm ready to be replaced here. And maybe something on those terms was happening with Adrian as well, thinking, okay, I'm being put a little bit aside, so I still have this flame and I still want to do something in Formula One.
It's interesting because this isn't the first time this has happened. There have been many occasions when Ferrari have tried to get Newey multiple times, and you know, he's always said no. And I think maybe 15, 20 years ago, it was because he had a young family based in the UK. He didn't want to go and live in Italy. I think his first wife didn't want to live in Italy. He's remarried. He's 65 years old. He's got enough money to buy his own Caribbean island. He doesn't need to do anything. But as you say, he is a workaholic. I think if he was sitting on a Caribbean island, you know, he'd just still be sketching racing cars and then just be like Schumacher. He just couldn't cope with the fact he wasn't competing anymore. And I don't think I've ever met a more competitive person than Adrian Newey. So I just think that there is a prevailing wind here that could make the Ferrari thing happen, where in previous 3-4 times they've tried, the circumstances are wrong. Maybe the opportunity to work for Lewis, one last dance. And at the end of the day, it's so exciting for Formula One, isn't it? You know, the Lewis in a Ferrari is exciting enough, but Lewis in an Adrian Newey designed Ferrari, Formula One benefits when Ferrari is competitive. That's what happened with Schumacher going there in the mid-90s. It feels to me a bit like the mid-90s again. So interesting to hear that you think that Ferrari's on the agenda as well. But by a weird twist of fate anyway, Newey was the designer of the last F1 car that Ayrton Senna raced 30 years ago. For many people, the award-winning documentary movie Senna provided a window into the great man and his story in an arc that spanned 10 years from his F1 debut in 1984 to his death at Imola. Now, the writer and producer of Senna is Manish Pandey. He's since made Grand Prix Driver Series on McLaren for Amazon. He made the Bernie Eccleston docuseries Lucky, and he's currently shooting a film on the former Ferrari boss, Luca di Montezemolo, who tried to hire Senna just before he died at Imola, and the story of their meeting is in that film, Manish told me when we met. I went to see him to draw the connection between Senna and F1 as we know it today. I hope you enjoy our chat. Manish, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. Let's start by looking at what you found most compelling about Ayrton Senna, the man, and also his story.
I mean, I think the first qualifier is I never actually met him. I Silverstone 1992 was the closest I ever got to him. It was about 3 meters away when his car stopped. I like to fool myself that he looked into my eyes as he walked past and went like that, but I don't think he did. I think he was heading towards McLaren. You and I actually go quite far back on Senna, so I think you probably know the answer to this better than most people, but I got a chance to speak at the premiere in Brazil, and I got to say something that was very, very close to my heart about who he was and why, as a boy, I would be so in love with a character like that. And I think, you know, it comes from somewhere quite political and a little bit dark in Britain's history. I think, you know, growing up in Britain in the 70s and 80s, nobody would imagine that there'd be a prime minister of Indian origin 40 years later, or a home secretary, or forget about two. You know, it was quite a tough place to be a foreigner. And I always felt his journey, to some extent, you know, you're egotistical as a teenager, his journey reflected mine in a massively amplified way. But you had this outsider. He came into a very European sport where kind of, you know, everyone knows the best. And I remember before he made it into Formula One, they made a big deal of the fact they called him Harry because they couldn't pronounce Ayrton. And I think there it is. It's summed up beautifully. And I love the idea of this guy being better at qualifying, better at racing, better in the wet, better in the dry, but also better technically than kind of his quote unquote European counterparts. Even though he's genetically European, this idea that this sort of Johnny foreigner from Latin America, where quote unquote their blood must boil hot and, you know, they can't possibly be thinking, I think if you're growing up in a country where you've got quite hardcore football hooliganism, you know, the terraces are shouting things that you would never say now, not in this country, to see somebody like that just kind of emerge, how can he not be your hero?
That's really interesting. That's a very interesting perspective on it. I mean, you worked so hard, didn't you, over many years to get the Senna family on board, get them fully bought into the project. And I wonder, what did you observe when you actually did this? You know, you launched it. Of course, they were there at the premiere in Brazil. I remember that. I was there myself. Very lucky to be there. What did you observe of their reaction to the way the world responded to Ayrton's story through your film?
That's a... it's a really pointed question. I think Senna existed as a kind of ideal for them after his death. And that death wasn't, I mean, you know, in a previous life I was a doctor, and there are two ways people basically die. It's an expected death, somebody's older or whatever, or you have sudden death. And I think sudden death robs you of the ability to really reflect on your emotions, reflect on how you're going to get through all of this. And I think we have to remember that the movie actually came out in 2010. So it came out 16 years after he died. And the thing about movies, the thing about great television, the thing about storytelling like this is if it's done properly, it's very, very emotional. If it's very emotional, it's very evocative. And I think what we did was, it's not meant to sound mawkish. I think we brought him back to life. But I think what was really painful for them is we killed him again. And I think it was impossible to explain how it was. I remember a very brutal episode, actually. The family obviously had a lot to do with the film. You know, they really helped us. They really supported us. They backed us. They trusted us. And we promised we'd show them as soon as we had a cut good enough. And the only time to do it, weirdly, was around the Monaco Grand Prix 2010, which is the Cannes Film Festival. And because working title, Universal had financed the film, they have access to cinemas. But the only cinema that was available between 12 and 2 on a, I think Bruno was at the race then. So it was on a Friday, it's Thursday or Friday, of the Monaco Grand Prix. And you go in there, I sat between Viviane Senna, his sister, and Bianca Senna, his niece. And we were watching, and you could feel they were sucked in. And I remember, probably shouldn't say this, but in the second Senna Prost accident, Viviane, I think she actually made a fist, you know. There was a kind of visceral moment. And it's, you know, it's part of being dragged into the pantomime of cinema. But the brutal bit, and I think the most reflective bit, was when we got to Imola, I whispered to Bianca, I think we should swap seats. And she just knew. She sat there, she put her hands into her mum's hands, and sitting next to them, it was quite a thing to see, and it was awful. It was really traumatic. And we had to do it. We had to show his death. But I wasn't quite prepared for how emotional, how visceral, how painful it would be, because it's important to remember that neither of them were there at Imola. And you're also seeing your brother stroke uncle, and he's 35 feet, his face is 35 feet sort of tall or whatever. And so you're right inside his mind, you're right inside the garage, you're not peripheral. And suddenly we were turfed out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you're now in bright light on the street in Cannes, and you're just hugging. And, you know, it was incredibly emotional. But, you know, she said we did it right. And, you know, you can't do more than that. You really can't.
Well, as you well remember, I had a similar reaction. You showed me an early cut of it, and I remember we got to the last scene where he's kind of cutting some food in a tent, and he's carting, and he looks up at the camera, and I completely lost it at that point. I didn't realise my emotions were that close to the surface, but, you know, having known him a bit, and obviously having seen it, but that just that why that moment made me so upset, I don't know.
It was Asif that really wanted to end it with that look, because he felt that what you shouldn't forget is that this was, you know, this wasn't just a 34-year-old superstar driver. This was actually, in some ways, was just a 19-year-old boy, you know? Yeah. That's kind of what he was in his soul.
So. Yeah, it was. It was brilliant, that look. It's one of the best moments. So you know, 30 years on from Senna's death, you and I went on the 20th anniversary to see who would turn up at Imola on the 1st of May, and it was an extraordinary day.
It was a zoo.
Both Ferrari drivers turned up completely unexpectedly, wearing Alonso and Raikkonen, wearing blazers and ties. I mean, what? And there was all sorts going on. It was a very interesting thing.
That was Stefano Lai's hijacking of the 20th. It became a Ferrari event.
It was really strange.
Genius.
It was really strange. I was working for BBC at the time, and we made a really interesting little program about it, which people can dig out from the archives. But look, I mean, 30 years on from now, you've got, we'll come on to talk about how Formula One's changed, and particularly these new audiences that Liberty Media have brought in to the sport, younger, more female, etc. But I mean, what does Senna represent now? Those guys are kind of finding him through YouTube. They're getting really into their fandom of the sport, and they're going backwards, and you know that they're finding it. I can see that. I get messages from people who are finding things I did, you know, from 10, 15 years ago. And so they're soon locking onto this character, Ayrton Senna. But what do you think globally he represents today and from Formula One point of view?
I genuinely think that in some ways he's the last real deal driver, if that makes sense. It was he was so complete, not just as a driver but as a human being. And I once said this, the thing about Senna was you could have made that film about anyone else with pretty much the same beats, but there's something about him that makes you feel, and that authenticity is you can't fake it with a camera angle, you can't fake it with a sound bite, you just can't. He didn't perform, that's who he was, and that's something that we felt. And I remember, you know, Atif and I spent so much time looking at archive, and there's a consistency in the archive with him. I mean, one of the early scenes is Senna in a Williams. It's his first ever Formula One drive. Now, he's got a helmet on. How do you emote with a helmet on? The visor's up. It's a side angle, so you can't see his face. But what does he say? You can almost feel the tears in his eyes as he prays and says, I'm going to thank God he's given me this amazing gift. Young people are no different today to young people of 30 years ago. You know, I think we're looking for heroes.
And it's interesting what you say about it, because also we're looking for authenticity. I think that younger generation today, obviously we've both got sons who are of that Gen Z group, and authenticity is everything for them. Anything that's phony or fake in a social media world is out, isn't it? And Senna had that. He definitely had it. I think I remember asking Bruno Senna once what he thought his uncle's greatest quality was, and he said commitment. He said he thought that what made Senna special as a racing driver and everything in life was commitment. He was all in. And that, obviously, he paid the ultimate price for that. But I thought that was quite interesting. And intensity is the other word I would use.
But that's a very pointed thing to say, because I think that's exactly it. The number of times people say, oh, it's fixed or it's contrived or whatever. There's a guy who paid the ultimate price for the thing that he wanted to do in his life, and it just doesn't get any more authentic than that. It's a double underline, isn't it, at the end? So everything you watch before that, you realize he meant it. All of that is meant, you know, and it's a beautiful thing. And so I said, you can turn this on in 20 years' time and it will be exactly the same thing, you know, Senna will be. My strange thing now is I sort of look at him. I saw the film for the first time in 10 years last week, and I was shocked as to how young he is when we start the story, but how old he looks by the time you get to the end. I mean, you see the bags under his eyes, you see the crow's feet, and that's 10 years in Formula One. It's 30 years in any other job. It really, or it was at the time, for sure.
Yeah, they definitely age, don't they? No question about that. I mean, so I've got this theory, because having sat through having enjoyed a lot of the premieres, and also sat through different screenings of it with different audiences, the Senna movie back, you know, whatever it was, 10, 12 years ago, what struck me immediately was how the film crossed over. And, you know, there was, you know, women in the audience loving it who knew nothing about Senna at all. Its success in terms of the box office, the awards that you won, you know, BAFTA's Sundance Awards, tremendously successful film. The Times, I think it was recently, said it's in the top four
best sports films ever made. I mean, that's incredible, fantastic. Many congratulations on that accolade. But for me, it was its crossover quality. This wasn't a motor racing film. You didn't need to be a motor racing buff to watch Senna. And I think that was the gateway to Drive to Survive that came since then. So, I mean, I don't know if you agree with that. I wonder whether Drive to Survive would have worked or would have been what it is and would have had the appeal that it's had were it not for what you did with Senna. And obviously one of the producers was involved with the Drive to Survive. So there is a DNA thread there. Yeah. Do you agree with me? And what is that quality then that you captured there that they've got in Drive to Survive?
I think sports documentaries before then, with the exception probably of When We Were Kings, were about scores, were about the game, about the match. And I think, actually as a team, I thought we were a really good little team on Senna, because what we had is we had, James is very commercial. He could always see it in a very commercial way. And James is kind of, you know, the force behind Drive to Survive. Asif, very, very artistic, always looking for the drama. And beautiful eye, you know, can just go, that's a beautiful shot, that's a rubbish shot. And I always felt I had that emotion and, if you like, authenticity. I wanted things to be accurate.
You were the storyteller amongst them.
Yeah, in terms of, I mean, I think we're all storytellers, but I think with me, it was very particular. Like, look, we can't do that. That's cheating. We can't move that scene there, you know, and doing that. And I think that what you have with Senna, I mean, why it crosses over, I think, is him. He makes you feel. If you're a young boy, he's a hero. If you're an older woman, he's your son. If you're a young girl, that is your lover. And by playing him and not the sport. So, very simple example. If you were to ask people today in Formula One, give me Senna's top five moments, I can bet you 90% of them would say, first lap of Donington, that's what I would put first. Well, it's not in the film. We have one frame of it in the film. And trust me, we tried really hard. I remember sort of going, oh, but we got to get it, we got to get it. But actually, I remember even in the original treatment, there was a very simple line saying, despite his genius, he was able to achieve very little in 1992 and 1993. So if you understand what I've just said there, there's a great sporting moment in what's supposed to be a great sporting documentary, possibly his greatest sporting moment, but it's not in. Mm. You can see why it crosses over, because we refuse to make it about the sport. We always made it about the man. And what happens is, in that year, you know, 1991, he's on top of the world. And what we had to show you was in the next 2 years, despite not losing any of his skill, his magic, he was emotionally at the bottom of the world. Yes, he felt great after winning at Donington, but would he have traded that in for a Williams drive in a minute?
Mm. Well, he offered a drive for nothing later that year, didn't
he? That's the point, and that's the story. And I think our storytelling in that way was really clever, because we weren't going to be slaves to the greatest goal ever scored or the greatest opening lap. We were going to be slaves to the emotional kind of reference point of our character at any point in the movie. And I remember just arguing with Asif about 1989. For me, the politics, I still, when I watch a film, I still kind of feel it comes from nowhere. Suddenly, you know, they're kind of arguing. And of course, we know the official story is it was about the broken agreement at Imola and the opening lap and who goes in first and who goes in second and all the rest of it. But, you know, it works. It works without getting into all of that politics, because there's plenty of politics, he said, that follows. So you're telling an emotional truth, even if you can't always tell the absolute typewritten truth, whether it's in the car or out.
So, I mean, people have tried to do Drive to Survives and failed. You know, even MotoGP didn't really work very well. There've been some success, been cycling, bit of golf, bit of tennis, whatever it may be. Other people have tried to make sort of sports documentary films, you know, not necessarily landed like Senna, not sitting there in the top four all-time films. What is it about Formula One that lends itself, do you think, particularly to this sort of storytelling? Is it just because the people that practice it, whether they're the drivers or even the team bosses, that cast of characters that we've got, there's just some crazy intensity about. I mean, I grew up as son of a racing driver. I know what that fire that burns in a racing driver is like, and you can see it when it goes out in their eyes when it's time to retire and it's not there anymore, you know. But is that what it is? Or what I mean, coming in from the outside as you did, you know, what is it about F1?
I think it's show business. I think it's genuinely show business, and it has been for a long time. And I think Bernie spotted that very, very early. And I think that whatever you say about the technical qualifications or the commercial qualifications of people, or whether they're great lawyers, there's something of the showman in Formula One people or showwoman. And I think you see that. You go into a paddock, everyone's looking at everyone else. Everyone notices what everyone's doing. If somebody's slightly changed their clothes or moved teams, there's lots of gossip. But I think people understand presentation in Formula One in a way they don't. I mean, I've been around MotoGP. I would say something controversial. My first ever MotoGP race was Jerez in, I think it was 2017, and it just blew my head off. I don't think I'd been to a Formula One race that exciting in my life. The atmosphere in the paddock was slightly different. It was a more villagey atmosphere. Everyone knew everyone. I remember, in fact, the Yamaha guys had run out of mozzarella and they were all running to Ducati, who gave them mozzarella. So it has this beautiful quality of helping each other, of fostering, you know, each other's teams, healthy competition. Formula One's paddock, it's just full of velociraptors in dinner suits. It's all about the way you look, it's about total ruthlessness. Can that make for great drama? You bet. Because actually, for all of the contrivance of Drive to Survive, I think it does touch upon a reality, quite a profound reality. Toto competes with Christian when they're on camera. And it just reflects exactly what they're doing behind scenes. And I think that's why it hits. Because again, I think you are seeing, you can't sometimes tell the exact truth, but you're feeling the truth there because they're competing.
Interesting. Yeah. I think you're probably right. So let's bring it up to the present day then. Obviously, you made this, the Lucky series about Bernie Eccleston that was on Discovery. You're working now though, on a project which is very interesting. I don't know how much you can say about it, but you're making a series about the legendary boss of Ferrari, Luca di Montezemolo, the guy who put the dream team together, Jean Todt, Ross Brawn, Rory Byrne, Michael Schumacher, that basically wiped the floor with everybody in the late 90s, early 2000s. Amazing guy. I know him reasonably well. Extremely animated, very good communicator. So, what can you tell us about that project and when will we see it? And
so it's a film. We've decided to tell it as a film, and we will be getting shooting in Italy in June. And I've been working with Luca on and off for 2 years to put this together. I mean, these things are like oil tankers. They just take forever to do. But I hope it's a very different piece to Senna. It's a very different piece to Lucky. This is a story where you meet a man who's ostensibly a farmer, who's also had a very big business career behind him in the last decade, post-Ferrari. But I think the kernel of the story is you've got a great Italian. And he said something that never stopped resonating with me, which is, to understand Ferrari, you have to understand Italy. And to understand Italy, I think you've got to hear that from a great Italian and his friends, and you have to see him as a fish in water, because what's extraordinary about, for me, Italians is they have this ability to take these very simple ingredients and turn them through some magic into something that you're in love with, you know. And Ferrari is a different car to anything else. A proper pasta pomodoro in Italy, it's something to do with their tomato, their olive oil, their garlic, their pasta, but it's just magical, isn't it? And I think that's what our story is about. It's about those amazing ingredients that only Italians have. That, you know, to quote him, he said about Ferrari, he said, "We didn't sell cars, we sold dreams." And I think that's the story. It's about this man who creates dreams. And he is a very, very special man, incredibly intelligent. Don't let that kind of good-looking, debonair Italian facade fool you at all. Categorical brain. And hopefully what we'll do is we'll get some stories that you don't really read about. And I think the two really simple examples: he was chosen by Enzo Ferrari in 1973 to go there. He'd just done a postgraduate degree from Columbia in international law after doing an undergraduate degree in law at Sapienza, the Oxford of Italy. Very bright man. gets a first-class degree, and then goes and spends a month at Maranello with the old man. The factory's closed. The Italians have gone, and he's there for 30 days, day and night, eating, drinking, listening to the old man, just soaking up what Ferrari is. And he's the last, in a way, apart from Piero, the old man's son, link to that era. And then he goes back to that company after the old man has died, and the company's failing. They can't sell cars. They're a joke in Formula One. I mean, an absolute joke in Formula One. And within 5 years, Michael's driving for the team. They're producing starting to produce some of the best road cars. That journey's beginning. And by the time he leaves, I mean, you know, it's Ferrari and McLaren. Yeah. So it's a beautiful story, I think.
So, I mean, there's so many things, of course, that Montezemolo could tell you, and so many stories and things. But I guess as we're talking about Senna in this podcast, there famously was supposedly a meeting between the two of them sometime not long before Senna died. Is that going to feature?
Yeah, definitely. I think it was the 28th, so 30 years ago yesterday. Senna had a bunch of products that he'd launched as part of his post-racing life future. That was Carrara bike, I think the Monte Grappa pen and the Ducati motorbike. When he'd done of those launches, he went to see Luca at his home. And it's quite a spooky thing. In his drawing room, I mean, Senna sat in one of those chairs with him and discussed post-Williams going to Ferrari. And they talked contracts. They talked, broadly speaking, you know, when he thought he could come. Luca even thought there was a possibility that 95 would be, you know, there were certain clauses that may or may not have worked out, but they could certainly explore them. But for 96, he wanted Senna, and I think he would have gone.
And when can we see it?
hoping that we'll have it, have all the post and everything done end of this year, early next year.
Fantastic. Can't wait for that. Manish, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, James.
So, Julianne, what do you take out of that?
Oh, it was a brilliant chat. Congratulations for that. It was the one thing that struck to me was when he was mentioning about not being from British family growing up in the UK, and how he would see Senna as an example of someone just outside of the establishment trying to win in Formula One, and feeling, okay, I'm an outsider, I'm an European. And that's something that is very strong for us, because I was talking earlier about him being a storyteller. He also promoted this story that Jean-Marie Balestre, which is someone who any Brazilian would hate, absolutely hate, because of the whole storytelling about him being very hard on Senna. And Senna was always trying to make it look like, and probably he was right, by my experience in F1, I think he was right, that Brazilians are seen as people who are maybe a bit emotional and are not to be taken seriously, and he was there to prove a point. So, and many times Senna even overreacted to some things that were done to him. It was probably because of that, and that is a connection that we feel a lot, because how this was interpreted in Brazil, because it's good to give you a background on how bad it was like to live in Brazil at that time. I think it was the worst time in Brazil's history to be a Brazilian. Inflation was over 1,000% a year in April 1990. I remember growing up, it's very faint memories, but my dad would get his salary and we would travel 100 kilometers to buy food and to stock food as if it was war, because then next day the food would have a different price and then the salary wouldn't be as good. So Senna was winning at that time when Brazil, even the football, was not doing well. For Brazilians, when the football is not doing well, it just means that the country is going really downhill. But he was the one winning races. So I think that's why winning races and telling us, you are a Brazilian, I am a Brazilian, and we can be at the top. That was a message that was very strong for him, and is still very strong until today. Even when Brazil won the World Cup in 94, the players gave interviews recently saying, we won it for him because he made us believe that we could win it. So that was very important, and he has to do with all this thing. You are an outsider, you are not an European, you go there and you beat them all.
But he was almost always a bit of an outsider, wasn't he, in that sense that you're talking about? He was wronged, as you mentioned, and then he was always fighting the institution of F1, the FIA. And do you think since Senna, there have been other drivers that have used him as inspiration then as outsiders? Because it's so European, or it used to, very certainly used to be very European in terms of the racing circuit. From your perspective, Julianne, do you see that a lot of outsider drivers, they're not really outsider obviously, but just non-Europeans I should say, they kind of pin Senna up, and because he fought so hard, and that's also another reason why he is still so relevant today.
I interviewed Perez about it recently, and he pointed out that the most important for him is that Senna showed as a Latin America you can be winning in Formula One. So there is that in the background, but I don't see anybody capitalizing on it because they haven't won. You have to achieve something in order to claim that. And I think the closest we can get to is actually Lewis Hamilton, who is a massive Ayrton Senna fan. And he understands what Senna was standing for, and he's trying to do the same as well.
Yeah, Hamilton absolutely considers himself to be just as much as an outsider, doesn't he? For me, the interview that you did, James, was what I took from it. The film is superb, and I'm not just saying that because you've done the interview. From what Manish was saying there, it's just how raw it still is. We're having this conversation 30 years on from his death. But certainly when you watch the film, and even when you talk to people, if you know, lucky enough to be in the paddock and talk to people who knew Senna, it's like he was walking around yesterday almost. It's so fresh. And that comment that Manish makes in the interview, you know, we brought him back to life and then we killed him all over again. And I remember the first time I watched the film actually, and obviously you know the ending, you know what's going to happen. And still being in disbelief as you watch it and having conversations even now, you just think, oh, what could I do differently? Could I turn back time? How could you change it? And you still can't actually get your head around the fact that Senna died during that race. And I was reading a good piece the other day, and it was talking about Sid Watkins, and obviously he was the head of medical at used to be Silverstone, and then brought in to cover the whole of Formula One. And he was the doctor when Senna died, and those two were very, very close. And he described working on Ayrton Senna when they pulled him out of the car as, you know, working on your own child. And it's a very close-knit community, Formula One. And if anyone is in need, you know, everyone will come to your help. And it was really telling in that sense, like listening to what Sid Watkins was saying. But then Manish really put that on the screen, how close it was, how people felt about him. And I remember being 10 years old in 94, and I remember exactly where I was when I watched that race. And I was with my brother in his bedroom watching it on this tiny little TV. And I can still think now how I felt when it happened, and the confusion around it. And that interview, just listening to it, it really took me back there and how it feels. And whenever you talk to anyone about Senna, they are also in the same place. You know, if you're old enough to remember and have watched the race back then, it's just how fresh his death is in everyone's mind. And because he is so huge, because he is so important to Formula One, as we've discussed, that film, I mean, there's a reason it resonated outside of Formula One as well. You know, I mentioned earlier, he died doing what he loves, and he pushed himself to the absolute limit of what was capable, and at times beyond it. He was magic. His talent was unbelievable. How he drove the car, how he felt it, how he was so intuitive. You know, you could drop him into any car, and you talk about how he moved to Williams. It didn't quite mesh with him at the very, very start, but he was such an amazing driver, what he was managing to get out of that car. And he almost defies belief somehow. And I know a lot of people say, oh, you know, as time passes, you remember it differently, and perhaps he gets put on a pedestal. But even at that time, back in the 90s, he was a three-time world champion. And obviously, we'll never know what he could have gone on to win, but certainly there would have been more world championships. And just listening to Manish there, and obviously he mentioned he never got to meet him, but meeting the family and sitting in the screening with Senna's family, watching it, and just how they grabbed each other's hand, his sister and his niece, they grabbed each other's hands during certain incidents in the film. And I think for a lot of people with Senna, you can almost feel it in yourself and what he meant to you. And it's still so raw. That's what I take away from it.
It's funny for me. I grew up in a racing family. My father was a racing driver. So as a kid, I got used to the idea, especially in the late 60s, early 70s, that some of his friends kind of never came round to the house again, you know, because they got killed racing cars. And so I kind of, perhaps I built a little bit of a protective shell, but I was there at Imola that weekend and I spoke to Senna. I cherish my memories of speaking to Senna from 1991 onwards. I did some interviews with him. I spent time with him. And it's one of the most special things I have, that I had that experience to know him. But I spoke to him for a couple of hours before he got in the car in that race. And he was really out of sorts. You know, Roland Ratzenberger had been killed tragically the day before. And you could see he just wanted to be anywhere else in the world but there right now. And he kind of had this enormous burden on him. And it was a kind of a spiritual thing. I'm not a spiritual person, but if I was, I probably would have got quite overwhelmed with that. And it's all wrapped up in the narrative. And I think just to close on this topic, I mean, you mentioned earlier on, I think a brilliant point, that Senna was a fabulous storyteller of his own story. And that brings me to this question that I put to Manish, that, you know, part of why Senna was such a success is because the story is so compelling. They told it brilliantly. They kept it in the moment. There was no modern-day older-looking Ron Dennis or older-looking Alain Prost. Everybody was the age they were at the time, so it's captured forever in time. But I do wonder, the narrative of that, just briefly, Drive to Survive, I don't think Drive to Survive happens without Senna having broken through that glass wall, if you like, of how sports storytelling in our sport should be. What do you think?
It's a good point. I had never thought about it before listening to the interview. The thing with Senna is really special because he was this guy who could connect to anyone. You don't have to like Formula One to like Senna. There was something about what Manish says about his look. It was an intensity there, authenticity there as well, that anyone could feel what he was feeling. That people who don't know what tire grips are or engines or whatever, but you could feel that he was giving everything. So Senna is really special in that sense. But also Senna taught us in a way that we could look at everyone in Formula One as individuals, telling their own stories. And these stories are interesting. If you dig deep, they are very competitive people, just absolutely going for it, traveling all over the world. This is very interesting, and it takes a certain type of human being to do even what we do, but especially what they do at the track. There's a lot that goes on around this Formula One thing that attracts very strong characters, and with very strong characters who have the good stories, and with good stories you don't need tires in sector 3.
I completely agree with you, and it's great how today's Formula One drivers the smart ones have worked out they can tell their own story. Of course, they can't control some of the bad things that happen to them on the track, but that's another story altogether. So listen, we've heard about Senna's legacy in Formula One, but what about his broader legacy? The Instituto Ayrton Senna was set up in 1994 by the family with a mission to provide opportunities for Brazilian children through education. As it celebrates its 30th anniversary, the Institute can be proud of having helped over 36 million, yes, that's right, 36 million children in Brazil. I got online with Bianca Senna, Ayrton's niece, to reflect on this legacy. Bianca, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, especially during the celebrations of the 30 years legacy of Ayrton. Ayrton's life, Ayrton's values, and also the Institute.
Tell us a little bit, Bianca, what he was like as an uncle, as a man, and the impact he had in Brazil way beyond sport.
Ayrton, for me, I was 14 years old when he passed. He was, for me, my uncle, and he was a great role model as someone that was always, you know, pushing for whatever he was doing. You know, even if it was a jet ski ride, he was always trying to, you know, make it perfect, look at the details of the engine and making different changes on it to make sure that, you know, it was perfect. And he was the one, you know, teaching me how important it is to do everything with passion, heart, and especially with the best that you can. So for me, that's my, you know, my biggest memory of him, like being someone that is always, you know, really truthful to his values and someone that is always pushing to make sure that he's doing the best that he could in every situation.
And that obviously really resonated with the Brazilian people. He was a global superstar during his lifetime, but he's still as famous today in a way as he was back then, is my understanding. Is that right?
Yeah, Ayrton continues to be a symbol of the Brazilian people, because he showed the Brazilian people that even though we were most of the time is in a very difficult situation, you are able to overcome those challenges and become, a winner. And I think that's what, he represents for the country. And I think that's what he represents for everyone, because I think everyone is born with a potential. And this potential, that's something that you have within you, is what makes you so special. And to be truthful to this potential and make sure that, you use all the tools and the ways that you can to develop that potential, that's what Ayrton showed everyone that is the important thing in life, no matter the challenges that you have. And I think that's what, this is the DNA that we carry through the Institute and that we carry through the Senna brand and Seninha brand, which is our cartoon, which is like, we believe that everyone has their own potential and we want to make sure that we help each one develop that potential through their lives.
That's fantastic. And obviously that was the founding mission of the Institute. Can you tell us a little bit more in detail about the kind of work that it's done? Give us some examples.
So when Ayrton was in 94 on the vacation still, he spoke to my mother because he wanted to do something special for Brazil, to make sure that as he was able to, fulfill his potential and become what he was made to be, that all the children and youngsters in Brazil could do the same. In Brazil, we have a specific situation and challenge that, most of the children and youngsters are in public schools. So that means that, you have to have a very strong public school system and quality to make sure that all the children are learning. Unfortunately, this is not the case in Brazil. Like, from every 100 children that starts K-12, only 10 finish. And from this, only 5 has the right proficiency in Portuguese and 3, or actually 1 in math. So this is like a big challenge that we face in Brazil. And that's why we decided to work towards finding the best technologies, social and educational technologies, to make sure that the children learn on the, in their right age and properly until they finish, K-12.
Now, you run the Senna brand, as I mentioned. You see it, the Grand Prix circuits all over the world, the famous Senna S, you mentioned the cartoon and all the other licenses that you do. Can you tell us a little bit about the scale of that business and also how that works with the Institute from a funding point of view?
So the Institute, like everything that we do through our license, through the image of Ayrton and the licensing agreements that we have through Senna and Seninha, part of it always goes to the foundation. This is the way that we, since the beginning, started, funding the foundation, because the foundation doesn't get any money from public sector. So basically everything that we invest is through private sector, either by us as, the brands, or by other companies that want to make a difference in the Brazilian people's lives. The Senna brand has different verticals, I would say. So we have the speed vertical, which is we have the Senna, the McLaren Senna car, or, motorcycle, or even eVTOL that we made a partnership with Embraer, which is a company, one of the biggest airspace company in Brazil. But we also have entertainment. That's why we have the documentary that a lot of people have seen already. And we are launching the Netflix series in the end of the year, which is going to be a fictional series about Ayrton's life. We also have exhibitions. We have activations in different ways through the world. Like we have a partnership with Formula One Exhibition, the big traveling exhibition that you have. We also have things in licensing, like the normal licensing is, like when you see in the tracks, you have like the national cap, you have like the S t-shirt. We have partnerships with different brands. Like we have a Tag Heuer watch, some models that we are going to launch this year. Like we've been together for almost 10 years now.
And what does it mean, Bianca, to the family that 30 years after his death, you know, Senna's legacy is still helping Brazilian kids become the best versions of themselves that they can be?
For us, like we think that we made a tragedy become something that can, you know, change the lives of millions. I think, you know, his passing is still really hard, I have to say, and it's hard, like, when you are in those years that, you know, you have to remember that, because, you know, he had so much life, you know, ahead of him. But, you know, it was a tragedy. But we made this tragedy become, you know, something that changes so many lives, that is almost like he is in each of those lives that we are helping. And I think that's what moves us.
So finally, and thank you again so much for joining us, how can our listeners help?
Well, there are many ways. I think ideas are always great. Following us on our social media, senna.us or Senna Brazil. Also by buying our products. And finally, by, you know, being involved in education in Brazil, by, you know, donating to our foundation and making sure that you can be part of this change. Because this change is really important for Brazil. We are really, you know, in need of help.
Very, very best of luck for you with all the celebrations of this milestone, 30 years. And thanks again for joining us, Bianca.
It's amazing what they managed to do in 30 years. Because, of course, everybody knows what the Senna Institute is. And because of Senna's image being so positive, brands want to be in touch with them, so that's why it keeps going. And it's everything that Ayrton wanted to do in all his life, but mainly in the last months before he died. I actually spoke with a lot of people who met him for many years, and then they all mentioned the same thing, that he was kind of leaving a little bit the full competitive sort of guy a little bit behind, to be more in touch with this side of, okay, I want to give back to my country, I want to do something especially for children. He always wanted to be a father, he never managed to be a father because he was so focused on Formula One, but he wanted to have like as many children as possible, and I think that is fulfilled with the Institute. And it's something nice, so Bianca was mentioning the Seninha character, the cartoon character, and that's an interesting case because it's sold as many things and the money all goes to the Institute. And I see a lot of parents who want to show to their kids, oh, this is a guy I used to follow, this is a guy that was very important for me. So have this toy with the Seninha face, and this love for Senna goes on and on and on, also through the Institute. So it's a win-win for everyone, really.
Fantastic. Well, that's it for this edition of the James Allen F1 podcast. My thanks to Manish Pandey, Bianca Senna, Rebecca Clancy, and Julianne Serrasoli. Where can people find you on social media, Julianne?
Well, I'm on X or Twitter, Jul Serrasoli, on Instagram, MyF1Life, which is very easy to find. My website, julianneserrasoli.com.br, and at WOL, Universo Online, the website as well, YouTube. Everywhere.
We're not going to miss you then, clearly. My thanks to Jason, Matt and Dre for the production, and thanks to you, listener, for your valuable time. I hope you enjoyed it. Please like and subscribe, share the word on social and tell all your friends. You can email us on jamesallenonf1@motorsport.com. We'd love to hear your comments, your questions and your reflections on Ayrton Senna. You can stay up to date with all the latest F1 news online and on social media, on Autosport and Motorsport. And don't miss Brin and the Autosport F1 podcast for the in-depth stories and F1 weekend coverage, available wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back with another JO and F1 podcast very soon.